And to communicate with Terrible Tommy, you just send your letters or cards or whatever you want to send, boxes full of money, to Tom Metzger, P.O. Box 1687, San Jacinto, California, that's S-A-N-J-A-C-I-N-T-O, California, zip 92583, we'll get it, and subscribe to our radio show, too. Do it today. Well, how are ya, as Arthur Godfrey used to say, in which 90% of you people out there don't remember who Arthur Godfrey was. I'm not going to take time to tell you, but this is Thor's Day. That's right. So give thanks and wonderment to the mystical god Thor. Yeah, and it is December the 14th, 2017. We got a half moon up there. Got to watch that moon, because you can pretty well tell how people are going to be acting by the moon. Yeah. I know the cops always want to be off duty on a full moon, I'll tell you, because that's when things happen. Sometimes some pretty bad things. Well, I found out my problem with my electronics, and it's something I should have spotted immediately. it turned out to be causing all my problems was not the computer, it was the router. Yeah. Now, I used to be able to track that down simply when I was out there in Indiana. I'd simply unplug the input cable from the router, and then I'd run it directly to the computer. And if it was a router problem, the computer would work fine. I don't know why I forgot about that now. I guess that's the way it goes when you get to be older. But anyhow, with luck, I think we're going to be all set with this computer. I won't have to trash it. I hate to spend money, man. Well, we're going to go back today to our good friend and deceased good friend, Revelo P. Oliver. As I said before, one of the best intellectuals that the struggle has ever seen. We really lost a magnificent person, writer and thinker, when we lost him. He, like many of us, had worked with the John Birch Society for quite some time. And finally, in disgust, he left the John Birch Society just like I did and just like Robert Matthews did. A lot of us are ex-Birchers, but we got a lot of information out of the Birch Society. There is a lot of good information there, and Western Islands put out some really good books. And I can't take that away from them, but they're not quite our cup of tea, as far as I'm concerned. And there was always questions about Robert Welch, too. Some people used to say there was one of the bulletins that they put out in the John Birch Society where Robert Welch said, "We Jews." Now, I never was able to find that myself, and it may have been nonsense, but it's interesting. And also, he wanted to get our attention all away from the race, and anybody was a racist was a com simp, and there was another word he used for it too. And we was only supposed to think about anti-communism and be up to our neck in the Cold War situation, which most of us were. But while we were worrying about the Ruskies, too much about the Ruskies, they were selling our race down the drain. And I became very suspicious when the John Birch Society said that anybody that talked about race in your Birch Society meetings, you got to kick them out. Well, I could tell them right away that most of the people in the chapters that I ran, and I ran two or three of them, I was in there for 9 years, almost every one of them was racist. But they kept their mouth shut until after the meeting. So when the liberal communistic type progressives say John Birch Society was a bunch of racists, they were essentially right. Yeah, they were essentially right. Everything in my past has been a stepping stone, sort of like climbing up a pyramid, step at a time, go one thing to another, until I get what I need, and then I go someplace else and go up higher on the totem pole. And that's what I did. I got a lot of stuff out of the John Birch Society. And I'm trying to remember the man who influenced me a hell of a lot. His brother was a congressman from Ohio, I believe it was. And he did, he put out a documentary called Proofs of a Conspiracy, I believe it was, and we have it available. And I'll tell you, there's a hell of a lot of good stuff in there. I'll remember his name in about a week. But he got fed up with the Birch Society too and left. The thing that caused me to break with the John Birch Society, I may have told you this before, I was a chapter leader in Fallbrook, California. I had been a chapter leader in Redondo Beach, California. And we had a section leader call for a meeting of all the chapter leaders in a particular area. And when we got to the meeting, the section leader said, "Now, I want to tell you, I've got a list of books here, titles of books, and you can't have any of your members reading these books. And if you see them reading these books, kick them out." I stood up and I looked at the list and I said, "Hell, I've got every one of these books and I've read them all. What are you going to do about it? I don't let anybody, nobody tells me what to read." So I walked out the door, slammed the door, and that was the end of the John Birch Society for Terrible Tommy. The worst challenge you could ever make to me is don't read this or don't look at that and don't think this and don't think that, because you're gonna have a pain in the ass on your back if you do that to me. I've always been a total free speecher, and I'll die a free speecher, because I think if you've got free speech, you gotta win in the long run, or you can't lose so bad anyhow. And that's right. But if you start taking people's freedom of speech away, no matter how you disagree with it, I stood up and said that communists should have a free speech just like everybody else. You know? I've been on national TV and they tried to get me to condemn people. I remember on Geraldo Rivera, I was on his show about 9 times, I think, or a hell of a lot of times. And he put me on there on a panel with a Satanist, a witch, a homosexual, and a right-winger, I think. Put us all on there. Oh, and they guess who he put next to me? Al Goldstein of Screw Magazine. Now, that's got to be the one thing I'd react to the most in reality. And he said, "What do you think about it?" I said, "Well, I got no problem. He's got his free speech and I've got mine. He's totally free to say what he wants and I'm totally free to say what I want." Pissed Geraldo off. He wasn't right for the rest of the show. He expected us to get in a big fist fight because we were sitting right beside each other, and if we'd either one been a mind to, we could have slugged it out. But he laughed about it, and I laughed about it. I said, "I'm not telling Al Goldstein what to think or what to say, and he's not telling me what to think or what to say, and that's the way I live my life." It's a lot of the right-wing conservative Christian types, they say, "Well, you must agree with him. You must agree with that homosexual over there, and you must agree with that witch, and you must agree with that Screw Magazine guy." I said, "No, I don't have to agree with them. I'm just saying they deserve free speech, just like I deserve free speech." And guess who on the panel was the most upset with that? It was the right-winger, the right-wing conservative Republican. He was the worst one. He would deny everybody their free speech. You don't win an argument by cutting off a person's free speech, because if your ideas and thoughts are too weak to hold up in a debate, then you better get out of the fight. That's our problem. We don't get on television enough anymore to put our ideas out there with everybody else. I don't fear anybody as far as debating them, you know. I don't say I'm the best debater in the world, but I don't think I've ever looked too bad in debate. It's the progressives, so-called progressives, that are worst at cutting off free speech. Even worse than right-wing conservative type radio and TV people. They're pretty bad. They're getting worse, like Fox TV. But I'll tell you one thing. I love a good scrap. I love a good fight. And they can invite me on any type show like that, and I'll still hold my own. But I don't know. I guess I've laid my eggs and I've planted my seeds, so I don't have to do too much. Well, I'll continue from the great magazine Liberty Bell, by owned and operated who's now passed away, by George Dietz, who did us a tremendous favor. Probably the best favor we ever had was to put out all these magazines, because we've got them all, or most of them, and other people have some too, and we're not going to let them die, because the articles in these magazines are priceless. I've been photocopying a magazine every couple of weeks or a month and sending them to some of the prisoners. I know Richard's guitar, he loves them. He asked me to start sending them to him, and he really loves those Liberty Bell magazines, especially when we send him a whole magazine at a time, photocopied. You ought to do that if you've got a lot of good information out there. You should photocopy it and put it in the mail and send it to a person behind the wire. I mean, come on, guys. If you've ever been in jail or prison, you know how it is, how lonely it is. And without intellectual stimulation, they like to have you like that. That's the way they want you, without anything to turn you on, man. I've always said one of the reasons why we fail is because too many of our people never pick up our wounded at all. Not even a letter. Any ghetto nigger has got people writing him most of the time, family coming to visit him, all that kind of stuff. But the right wing is a pain in the ass as far as supporting their fallen. One of the POWs we help take care of, and that's David Tate. He gets quite a few visitors from his family. He's lucky. He gets support from his family, and they travel long distances to see him because he's in Missouri, and much of his family is out there in the Carolinas. Mahon hasn't had visitors. They won't even let his brother in to see him. So that's a problem there. And George, one POW that really needs support, he's in one of the worst prisons in the country, because it's down south where the people who love baby Jesus love to torment prisoners. Old Testament prisons. And that's George Loeb, L-O-E-B, and he's a creator. And I know there's a lot of creators out there that are sitting on their hands not doing anything. If you're down there close to where he's at, now his address is on our website, there's no excuse. Someone should go see him. It's too far for me at this time to go that far, but there's a lot of people that are down there in that area. Or at least send him mail, because he's doing life for defending himself against a crazed nigger in a shopping center. Nigger came at him with a block of cement, and he blew him away, but he got life. That's the typical. That's why you should have ultimate hatred for these prison people that run the prisons. I don't give a shit. The guards are just as, they're pretty bad. Once in a while, there's a good guard, but who would want to guard people in a prison cell? I mean, I don't want to even be a work in a zoo guarding animals. I mean, I don't like to see anything live in captivity, if at all possible. So anyhow, support these guys. Go up to our website, get their addresses. And don't be afraid they're all going to come and pick you up and drag you away. That's an excuse people use. I'm going to pick up where we left off yesterday in this great article, What We Owe Our Parasites. And I'm going to pick up where they're talking about Joe McCarthy, Senator McCarthy from Wisconsin. But I was wrong again. Instead, a friend of mine was right. He was at the time a member of the Central Intelligence Agency, which at that time included some Americans. And he happened to be in Wheeling, West Virginia on the 9th of February, 1950, when Senator McCarthy made his famous speech in which he stated there were 57 members of the Communist Party or of the Soviet espionage apparatus in the State Department. And of course, boys and girls, if you don't know how rotten the State Department has always been, then you don't know anything. The State Department is one of the most corrupt and vicious areas of our government, so-called government. Our keepers, our masters, our dictators. So if there's any overthrow, start with the State Department first. After the speech, my friend found an opportunity to talk to McCarthy alone. I know I read this to you yesterday, but you need to hear it again. He told him, quote, "Senator, you said there were 57 known communists in the State Department. If you had access to the files of my agency, you would know that there is absolute proof there are 10 times that many. But, Senator, you do not realize the magnitude and the power of the conspiracy you're attacking. They will destroy you, and they will destroy you utterly." But Senator McCarthy merely shook his head and said, quote, "No, the American people will never let me down," unquote. How many people have said that down through time? How many good people have been screwed because they depended on the American people, the American white people? He was wrong, too, you see. It's not necessary here to rehearse the steps by which McCarthy was destroyed. He was, of course, sabotaged from within his own staff. Well, yeah, he had a Jew, Roy Cohen, homosexual Jew, on his staff, and Kennedy Jr., the president's brother, later. The aliens who control our press and radio and the boob tubes spattering their slime over the country, swarms of ignorant and neurotic little shysters whom we call intellectuals issued from the doors of the colleges and universities shrieking and spitting as if they're want, and all that had its effect. But the conspiracy was able to silence McCarthy only by a somewhat less routine operation. They found an army officer who had been a military failure until Bernard Baruch promoted him to general, and who in 1945 should have been able to hope for nothing better than he could escape a court-martial and thus avoid being cashiered if he could prove that all the atrocities and all the sabotage of the American interests of which he had been guilty in Europe had been carried out over his protest and under the categorical orders from the president. The conspiracy took that person, and with the aid of their press, they did a quick masquerade job and dressed him up as a conservative. That was back when there were conservatives. They wrote speeches, and he was able to deliver without too much bumbling. They displayed his grin on all the boob tubes, and they elected him president. And, of course, Ike was elected with a mandate from his masters to stab Senator McCarthy in the back, as he did. And so the conspiracy plugged a small leak in the dike. I remember when Ike ran for president, I liked MacArthur myself, but I was only in junior high school at the time. And we used to go downtown to sandwich shop at lunch, and there are these Republican political workers were out in the street handing out badges, "I like Ike," so they were pinning those badges on all of us kids that didn't know shit from Shinola. And I remember that very well, that "I like Ike" push. Yeah, after I learned about what he did in Europe, not to gag a maggot, how he treated the Germans after the war. Another war criminal, just like Ollie North. They're all fucking all war criminals. Every one of them. Because if they weren't war criminals, they'd pull the plug and tell the nasty, tell all they know, and throw themselves under the mercy of the good American people. if there's any of those left. But how was it able to do that? Oh, yes, we could trace the whole operation step by step. We know that our enemies are sneaking and cunning. We know that they command the wealth of the world, including whatever is in the United States Treasury and through the income tax, whatever is in your pocket and mine. They can hire stupid, unprincipled Americans to do anything for them and to act as front men. But the real question before us is not their cunning and their innate evil. The deeper, more important, and far more unpleasant question is, what was and is wrong with the American people that made them and is still making them willing victims of their enemies? Well, it's obvious, the educational system and the entertainment system and the sports system. They're more interested in nigger ball, you know. I used to run into a lot of Klansmen who couldn't stay away from either nigger ball on TV or nigger ball in person, and then they claimed they were racist. They claimed they were hardcore racists and they were chasing around and worshiping niggers. Some years ago, it was customary for fast-talking confidence men to find some chump with $5,000 or $10,000 in cash and sell him the Brooklyn Bridge or the Holland Tunnel. And I hear that when the Pennsylvania Railroad began to demolish its station in New York City, someone bought it for $25,000 cash. Now, the swindlers in all these cases are undoubtedly wicked men. They deserve exemplary punishment. But you know, there must have been something wrong with the purchasers, too. Much as we may sympathize with them, we shall have to agree, I think, that they were not overly bright. Not the sharpest knife in the drawer. We Americans, you know, are regarded with supreme contempt by our enemies. Well, we've gotten to be judged with supreme contempt by our friends, too. Used to be our friends. Who describe us as in private, sometimes in public, in the most contemptuous terms. You may remember that some years ago, a man named Khrushchev was the manager employed on the conspiracies of state in Russia. He was invited to this country by his pal Ike. And he toured our land, honored and applauded by the press and even by some Americans. Soon after he returned, he told newspaper reporters in Vienna, quote, "The Americans? Why, you spit in their face and they think it's the do," unquote. I must confess to you boys and girls that when I was in junior high school at that time, when he came to this country, and the big argument was why they let him come here, I stood up for Khrushchev. For free speech. You can see how early my free speech started. I believed that he should be heard and people make a judgment. Maybe I was wrong. I don't know. The delicate phraseology reminded me of what I had been told by an acquaintance in Washington during the Second World War. This man, a veteran journalist, held a position of importance in one of the lie factories operated by the Roosevelt regime to keep the boobs pepped up with enthusiasm for sending their sons and their husbands into a senseless slaughter. At one policy conference, this man objected to a proposed lie on the grounds that it was so absurd that it would destroy public confidence, with the result that Americans would soon cease to believe anything that the agency manufactured. There was a great deal of debate over this question in this policy conference until it was ended by the agency's great expert to such matters. He was a man who, by the way, for some reason or other, had left Germany a few years before and come blessed the United States with his presence. This expert, being a bit ruffled by the debate, finally took his elegant little cigar from his mouth and said decisively, quote, "We spit in the face of the American schwein," unquote. And that ended it. The master had spoken. Why do we receive and deserve such contempt unless we have simply degenerated into a race of imbeciles unfit to survive in the world? There must be some ascertainable mental block that makes us so gullible, and if so, we must urgently need to identify it. That's the reason why I brought up the question of Senator McCarthy and what may have seemed history long past and abyss. That episode was obviously an antecedent of our present terrible plight, and when we try to look back at the obvious factors, such as an alien control of our channels of information, fake news, and finances, we know that there must be something back of that. And then we look at the obvious factor of which many are made aware only recently by the shocking behavior of so-called students in the so-called universities, and by the far more shocking behavior of the administrative officers and faculties of these diploma mills. We now see that the gang of sleazy racketeers headed by John Dewey has attained its goal. We realize that public schools have been for many years vast brainwashing and brain-contaminating machine that worked on the whole with great efficiency. It's machine to which we send our children to have their minds filled with grotesque and debasing superstitions, to have their instincts of integrity and honor leached from their souls, to be incited to premature debauchery and perversions, to be imbued with thoughtless irresponsibility, and to be prepared for addiction to mind-destroying drugs. An existence below the animal level, the public schools have indeed been the most powerful single engine of subversion that our enemies have used upon us. The rest of this hour would not suffice even to enumerate the ways in which these self-styled educators have accomplished their deadly work. When we go back to the affair of Senator McCarthy and look for a deeper cause, we can't, of course, blame the schools, which were doing then a little less openly the work that they are doing now, but that leaves us with the question, why did American people fall for that racket? Why were they gullible enough to be so easily taken in by John Dewey's hoax? Well, let us go back to 1917, when Dewey's fraud had gained control of only a relatively small area, and when the world was certainly a brighter and more pleasant place. That brings us, of course, to the time of Woodrow Wilson, another baleful figure in our history. I am not one of those who regard Wilson as entirely a villain. I think he was primarily a man who could intoxicate himself with his own words, and I think that he went through most of his life mistaking his hallucinations for reality, as surely as he did on the day of 1919 when he was driven in the early morning through the deserted streets of Washington, mechanically raising his hat and bowing to the applauding crowds that existed only in his feverish mind. I am therefore willing to believe that he believed a good deal of what he said, and although in his political life he was merely a marionette that danced and pranced on the stage as its strings were pulled by Jacob Schiff, Bernard Baruch, and the Warburgs, and their agent Colonel House, the fact remains that Wilson ranted to the American people about making the world safe for democracy. Well, where was there ever really a democracy? And a war to end all wars? Well, everybody knows that's bullshit. Nobody should have believed it at the time. And they believed him. Instead of calling a physician when he began to babble that errant nonsense, they let him plunge them into a world war. Which virtually limited to our race, and which enables us to put ourselves mentally in the position of others, but simultaneously exposed as to the risk, fancying that their thoughts and feelings are what ours would be. Wait a minute, did I skip something? Oh, wait a minute here. Pardon me, boys and girls. I think I skipped something here, which is normal for me. Yes, I did. Well, I never promised you a rose garden. A war in which they had no conceivable concern, and to use the power of the United States to make the results of that war as disastrous in the long run for Britain as it was for Germany. Now, I admit that the notion of a warless world is a pleasant and attractive thought, but people who believe that there can be such a thing should ask if Santa Claus, in whom they doubtless also believe. Let us go back to 1909, when American people were offered a plan for destroying nations that had been formulated again by a filthy degenerate named Mordecai, alias Karl Marx. Now, it's true that the promoters hired a few journalists, liberal professors, and other intellectual prostitutes to prove conclusively that the proposed income tax would never, under any circumstance, exceed 4% on the income of millionaires and could never affect anyone else, for the obvious reason that no federal government could possibly spend so much money. But the point is that the majority of the American people, the inheritors of a free government based on the premise that governments must be limited to essentials, must be tied down by the chains of a stringent constitution, restraining the exercise of all powers except those deemed absolutely necessary for national defense. You know, I've always made the point that a constitution will never in the long run protect you. Pieces of paper don't protect people. People, muscle, and blood is what protects you in your brain. Any group of people that depends for all time on a piece of paper to protect them are fools. Any constitution will either fall out of favor or disintegrate over a period of time. And then look what they did. It was a white man's document. They totally took the white man out of the Constitution. Those American people believed that hogwash. In effect, that the promoters were telling them in wheeling tones was, quote, "Come, little boobies, put your heads into the noose, and we'll do you lots of good," unquote. And the boobus little boobies stuck their heads in the noose, and so the country is now under the regime of the Great White Slave Act, and that's why we are where we are today. We could go much further back if we had the time. We certainly should go back at least to the 18th century, when weird mythology that what is now called liberalism and all the basic lies that are rammed into the minds of our children in the schools were manufactured by a motley and bizarre gang composed of agents of Weishaupt's great conspiracy, many ordinary swindlers and mountebanks, and quite a bevy of idealists were buzzing brains and twittering tongues. But I think that we have said enough to see that we Americans are suffering from a chronic disease of tropism that has invariably placed us at the mercy of our enemies by making us incapable of taking thought for ourselves. There is in us a weakness, perhaps a fatal weakness, that makes us not only listen to the babble of the self-professed do-gooders, but to do whatever they tell us to do, and to do it mindlessly, as though we were in a hypnotic trance and had surrendered our will to that of hypnotists. Now, I believe that this strange weakness, unlike so many of our peculiarities, is not a single congenital and hereditary idiocy. If that were true, we would not be here. Our remote ancestors would have been eaten long before the dawn of history. It is compound, it is, seems to me, of a perversion of the seven different qualities, a perversion affected and fostered by certain misunderstandings in the peculiar circumstances that resulted from prosperity, power, and world dominion. We of the West achieved for ourselves and enjoyed in recent centuries. All of the seven elements of our mentality that I shall enumerate are good qualities, at least in the sense that they are born in us, that we could not eliminate from our genetic heritage if we wanted to, and that we have perforce to accept them. We could comment at length on each of them, and it would be particularly interesting to contrast ourselves with other races at each point. But I must list them as briefly as possible, with only a word or two of explanation to make my meaning clear. First is imagination, which is highly developed in us, and vivid, and imagination, which means, among other things, that we have a spiritual need of a great literature, both a literature of vicarious experience and a literature of the fantastic and marvelous that transcends the world of reality. But this gift bears with it, of course, the danger that we may not distinguish clearly between a vivid imagination and something that we can actually see in the world. Second, the sense of personal honor, which is so strong in us and seems so fatuous and silly to other races. It is this, among other things, that gives us the conception of an honorable contest when men of our race meet as opponents in war. It gives us the knightly ethos that we see when Diomedes and Claudius meet on the plains of Troy, and in all the subsequent history and the story of our race. It also exposes us to the danger of behaving in knightly fashion to those to whom these standards are lunacy. The third is the capacity for objective and philosophical thought. Which is virtually limited to our race, which enables us to put ourselves mentally in the position of others, but simultaneously exposes us to the risk of fancying that their thoughts and feelings are what ours would be. The fourth is our capacity for compassion. We have a racial reluctance to inflict unnecessary pain, and we are ourselves distressed by the sight of suffering. That is, of course, a peculiarity that brings upon us the ridicule and contempt of the numerical majority of the world's population, who are beings differently constituted, the savages of Africa, who are not your masters in the sense that you have to work for them every day, find that the spectacle of a human being under torture is simply hilarious. And when they see a blinded captive with broken limbs squirming as they prod him with their red-hot irons, they laugh with glee. With a merriment, a real merriment that is greater than the funniest farce on the stage has ever excited in you. You may search the vast and respectable literature of China in vain for any trace of compassion for suffering per se. Fifth, our generosity, both as individuals and as a nation, which naturally brings on us contempt of those whom we would give abroad. The capacity for self-sacrifice is sixth, and that is, of course, highly developed in us, but it is a necessary basis for the existence of any civilized society. No people above the stage of unthinking savagery can survive in a world without some instinct or some belief which makes his young men give their lives for the preservation of society in which they are born. And seventh and last is the sentiment of religion, which of course is common to all mankind, although here again it takes a distinctive form in us. For 15 centuries, the religion of the Western world has been Christianity, Western Christianity, and there has been no religion now known or even imaginable that could take its place. But it is simply a historical fact, which we must deplore but cannot change, that only a small part of the population today, 12 to 15%, really believes that Christ was the Son of God, and the soul is immortal, and that our sins are punishable in a future life. That means that the religious instinct, which is part of our nature, finds in the majority of our people no satisfaction in an unquestioning faith, so that those frustrated instincts are available for exploration by any halfway clever scoundrel as shysters and punks who occupy the majority of our pulpits. The faith has lost what Pareto calls the religious residue of a people's, becomes its almost vulnerable point, its Achilles heel. It is the unsatisfied need for an unquestioning faith in a superior power. Now, a preservation of all these qualities in us operated during the centuries, and our dominance gives to us an utterly false conception of other peoples. We have imagined that by some magic we could convey to them not only our material possessions, but the qualities of our mind and soul. And we have always succumbed to the flattery of imitation. The capacity for imitating behavior is common not only to the all human beings, but to all anthropoids, as we all know from the proverbial expression, monkey see, monkey do. An ape's ability to imitate us, of course, limited. But with the exception of the Australoids, other races have the capacity to imitate us convincingly in externals. If they dress in our clothes, observe our social conventions, and speak our language, using the phrases which they can learn by observation, please us, and using those phrases even if they don't understand them, or if they regard them as preposterous, drivel, and nonsense, the members of other races could imitate us so plausibly that we believe them to be converted to our mentality and to our conception of life. And any shortcomings that we may notice in the performance of the imitator, we generously overlook or regard as endearing naivete. This capacity for imitation is possessed by savages, at least by some intelligent ones, and it has deceived us time after time. The British are as gullible as we are, hundreds and hundreds of times at least. They gave scholarships to blacks from Bozoland or Kenya or Nigeria or one of their other possessions, and the result almost always has been the same. With the money given to him, the savage bought himself a good wardrobe, attended an English school, learned to play soccer, attended Oxford, wrote a charming essay on Wordsworth or on ancient law, copulated with half-witted English women who thought him romantic and themselves broad-minded, and when he got tired of living in English generosity, went home to his tribe where he had a well-roasted baby for his meal. And served up to him as a delicacy in which he had been long deprived by the stupid prejudices of the stupid British. With some of the highly intelligent Oriental people, the capacity for dissimulation goes much further than that and approaches genius. That strange, unique international people, the Jews, who for all the time in which they have known to history have lived and flourished by planting their colonies in other people's countries, have owed much of their success to the chameleon-like ability to take on, when they choose, the manners and attitudes of whatever country they choose to reside in. They are highly intelligent people, quite possibly much more intelligent than we are. But all observers, notably Douglas Reed and Roderick Stolheim, have commented on the Jews' amazing ability to seem a German in Berlin, a Czech in Prague, an Italian in Rome, an Englishman in London, shifting from one role to another, with the ease with which a man might change his suit of clothes. The Jews have, of course, the great advantage of their skins are white, and that many of them resemble in features members of our race, even to the point of being indistinguishable, at least to the untrained eye, and including persons with such non-Oriental characteristics as blonde or red hair. I'm not sure, therefore, that the highest talent for dissimulation does not belong to the people that does not have that very physical advantage, the Japanese. Their ability to gain our confidence and appropriate our technology and science is simply phenomenal, as is obvious when they, living crowded together in a few poor islands, have accomplished. But their talent for dissimulation is equally great. I always remember the experience of a friend of mine who was in the late 1930s a professor of chemistry in a large university in which he called a strategic area of the country. The outstanding students in his graduate classes were four young Japanese, and partly because they were so apt at learning the more abstruse forms of chemistry, and partly because they were foreigners and so excited in him the generosity that is normal to us, he invited them into his home. In the course of 3 years, he became, he thought, to know them very well personally. Their manners and their English were excellent. They professed the greatest admiration for America and its institutions. They spoke, of course, of democracy in terms of high praise. They deplored militarism and fervently hoped that the world peace and understanding among all peoples. My friends were convinced that if only they could bring more young men like this to the United States, the policy of Japan would eventually change and the two nations would live thenceforth in perpetual amity. Then one day he found himself alone at a crossroads in the open country, some 20 miles from the university, waiting for some friends to pick him up in their automobile. They were late, and since the day was hot, he went to a nearby orchard to repose in the shadow of the trees. While waiting, he saw his four Japanese students come sauntering down one of the roads, evidently out of on a leisurely hike. At the crossroads, they stopped, looked up and down each road, looked around and saw no one. Then they straightened up and stood back and to back, each facing one direction, produced a Leica camera and photographed each road and then the surroundings of each diagonal and made notations on a map. They had, of course, come to our country not only to learn our chemical science for eventual use against us, but also incidentally to map about the territory around the university for future reference, should their army have occasion to invade us or should they have occasion to land a secret force on our shores. And they went about their work with the patient thoroughness of their race, doubtless chuckling inwardly at the naivete of big white boobies who freely deliver all of their hard-won knowledge to their natural enemies. Our minds have been beclouded by an even more dangerous misconception long annexed to us, to our religion. For centuries we have labored under the illusion of Western Christianity was something that could be exported, and only recent events have at the last made it obvious to us how vain and futile have been the labors and zeal of devoted missionaries for five centuries. When Cortez and his small but valiant band of iron men conquered the empire of the Aztecs, he was immediately followed by a train of earnest and devoted missionaries, chiefly Franciscans, who began to preach the Christian gospel to the natives, and they soon sent back home with an innocent enthusiasm glowing accounts of the conversations or the conversions they had affected. You can feel their sincerity and their piety and their ardor and their joy in the pages of Father Sagan, Father Torquemada, and many others. And for their sake, I'm glad that the poor Franciscans never suspected how small a part they had really played in the religious conversions that gave them such joy. Far more effective than their words and their book had been the Spanish cannon that breached the Aztec defenses, and ruthless Spanish soldiers who had slain the Aztec priests at their altars and toppled the Aztec idols from our sacrificial pyramids. The Aztecs accepted Christianity as a cult, not because their hearts were touched by doctrines of love and mercy, but because Christianity was the religion of the white man, whose bronze cannon and mail-clad warriors had made invincible. That was early in the 16th century, and we of the West have gone on repeating the fond mistake ever since, as the missionaries whom we sent to all parts of the world wrote home with innocent satisfaction, glowing accounts of numbers of hearts they had won for Christ. And it's only after the international conspiracy campaign of anti-Catholicism really got underway that most of us realized what had won all the hearts was primarily the discipline of the British regiments and the power of the white man. On many a shore in Africa, for example, missionaries eager to win the souls ventured to land alone, and the natives, after having a lot of fun torturing them to death, ate them, either cooked or raw, according to the local custom. What often happened was that a few months later, the British cruiser hove to offshore and lobbed a half dozen 4.5-inch high explosive shells into the native village, and if not a hurry, perhaps landed half a company of Marines to beat the bushes and drag out the dozens or so savages to hang on convenient trees. Unless the tribe was excessively stupid, they took the hint. The next bevy of missionaries was respected as somehow representing the God of thunder and lightning. And if those men of God distributed enough free rice and medical care with their sermons, they were able to make many converts. They could teach a ritual, and they could all perhaps inculcate a superstition that had some superficial resemblance to their religion, but as for teaching spiritual substance of Christianity, they might as well have followed the examples of St. Francis and delivered sermons to the birds. Although that is true that in some places in the former colonial possessions, missionaries are still tolerated if they pay very well. We have at last learned that the gospel follows the British regiments in the white man's ignominious and insane retreat from the world that was his. All of those factors have contributed, I think, to our strange toleration of the do-gooder and our incredible obtuseness in never asking against whom he is doing good. For it is unfortunate true that fully 80% of all those high-sounding projects of uplift and social justice are motivated not by concern for the supposed beneficiaries, but for greed or malice, but we never ask. That is why we have so many intellectuals battening upon us. They have discovered the safest and most profitable of all rackets. An intellectual is distinguished by two talents: a glib proficiency with words and a very sensitive nostril, so he can smell a $20 bill in your pocket a block away, and within 2 minutes after the delicious aroma reaches his nostril, the ideals are drooling down his jaw. You know the jargon, quote, the underprivileged, quote, equality of opportunity, quote, the culturally deprived, quote, underdeveloped nations, quote, emerging peoples, and the like, ad infinitum nauseum. And as you listen to this sing-song, the chances are you won't even notice his hand as it goes into your pocket. Now, we may be rich enough to be suckers, but we cannot afford the more elaborate kinds of do-gooding that are inspired by malice and hatred. But yet we tolerate them with a collective masochism that is simply suicidal. We have accepted an incredible inversion of values to the point that we have declared ourselves to be an inferior species, fit only to be enslaved, beaten, butchered at the whim of our betters. That is what the proposition amounts to, although of course it is daubed over with the vapid slobber of humanitarian drivel devised by our enemies and mindless multiplied by our own sniveling sentimentalists. It is not a new thing. If I had time, I would direct your attention in some detail to the vast, irreparably calamity brought upon our nation in the last century by a tiny group of vociferous, crazed fanatics, the abolitionists, who forced upon the South its tragic war for independence. I'm not defending slavery. Negro slavery is an institution. I believe that Jefferson and Lincoln were right in regarding it as a system. Oh, yeah. Hold on, boys. That was pernicious but not quite rational reasons, of which most important were, first, that it maintained on our soil millions of persons of a race radically different from our own and by our standards inferior, and second, that it resulted in some production of mongrels, pitiable creatures torn apart by the incompatible instincts they had inherited. As you know, it was the firm purpose of Abraham Lincoln to have all Negroes either return to Africa or, in the interest of the economies, so Central America. But that abolitionists were not rational. Well, he did get a bill passed to appropriate, I believe it was $250,000 to $500,000, to ship all the Negroes, or at least part of the Negroes, to Nicaragua. But they were about to implement it, and the Nicaraguan government said, no, we changed our mind. We don't want those niggers. They were, I am sorry to say, and they didn't have the balls to ship them back to Africa because, in one thing, there was a great desire for that black labor, cheap labor. They wanted to move them north into the industrial belt to break the back of white labor unions. They were, I am sorry to say, most of them Americans, including such persons as Wendell Phillips, Professor Eliezer Wright, and of course hysterical females like Lydia Child and Harriet Beecher Stowe. Their leader was William Lloyd Garrison, who was an American too, although he was financed by Isaac Mack and other Jews. They were a tiny group despised by sane Americans, North and South. But they ranted and raved until they got their way. They began to agitate in 1840 for dissolution of the American Union and for division of the United States by secession into two countries. And after 20 years of ranting, they finally persuaded the states of the South to take their proposal seriously. Well, that's enough for today, boys and girls. I'm read out. So we'll pick up on this. We've still got a few pages left, and we'll finish it up tomorrow. Yeah. As of 68, when this speech was made, Reverend P. Oliver was still nominally, at least, mouthing Christianity. But after that, I don't know when he made the change, but he went totally against Christianity, and his articles from a certain point on was he viciously attacked religion, period, which that's one of the things that really attracted me to him. So this pro-Christian, sort of nominally pro-Christian thing may have been partly to do with the audience he was speaking to, but I don't think he was a hypocrite. I think at that time, I know when he was with the John Birch Society, he was still talking about Christianity. I forget, he wrote a couple of books along those lines, but he did a switch just like I did, just what a lot of people did. We change if we're smart. A wise man changes his mind, a fool never does.
Because you have a steadiness about you, and I believe in you, but if it comes on, then you must be smarter than your enemy.
What are you trying to say?
The Americans, they're very smart, but sometimes they can be incredibly stupid. They spend all this money and time and energy on the so-called war on terror. They put satellites up in space. They can ram a smart bomb up a camel's ass from a situation room 5,000 miles away. But every time the U.S. kills an Al-Qaeda leader, what happens? There's a new one before the body is cold. You do it a million times, and they never get it because the real solution always eludes them. What is? Do nothing.
Nothing.
Nada. If you want to shut down a fundamentally flawed system, all you gotta do is step out of its way, and it'll shut itself down. Nature has a way of correcting itself.